You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the U.S. spent trillions of dollars fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Almost half of that went to contractors, and one-third of all the Pentagon's contracts went to just five suppliers. Answering a listener question, 1A takes a look at where the money went. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, who doesn't want to juice up their brain power? Tuning our minds to run at a higher level sounds like a good idea, and there are lots of people who'd be happy to take our money in exchange for supplements, trainings, games, and apps they say will boost our brains. But do they work? Results are sketchy at best, but there are some proven brain boosters, and a lot of them involve doing things with other people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you spent a lot of time thinking about how to boost your thinking and problem-solving skills? Do you do some kind of brain training app or seek out foods or supplements that might help with that? Do you do things with other people that seems to help stimulate your brain? Taking a class, a book group, playing games. I like playing games. You can join at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emily Willingham is a science writer with work appearing in publications including the New York Times, Scientific American, and Forbes. Her new book is called The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You write that people have used a lot of metaphors for the brain over the years, most recently like a machine or a computer. You have an interesting one, though. Our brain is kind of like a planet. Can you talk about why you like that metaphor?
I like that metaphor preferentially over talking about the brain being something that's wired, because wiring sounds so not organic. And I don't mean that in terms of like food that you eat that's organic, but I mean in terms of a living thing like a penguin or a tree. And it's not just about the neurons that are in it that form that wiring, but, you know, 50% of the other cells in our brains are not those kinds of cells. And all these things are interacting like almost like an ecosystem or a larger version of an ecosystem, which is a planet. And I think that metaphor captures that better.
And another part of that is there's one planet and there's another planet and there's lots of planets, and their gravity can affect the other orbits. One planet can affect another. And that's a key to a lot of the thinking behind what does work to make our brains better. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and exploring some of the things that are, you know, the claims that are made about making our brains better, they seem to focus so much on individual brains, like what can you do for your brain, right? And what I've learned through digging through a lot of the research is that we might be better off looking at what happens with the other brains around us as we work to improve ourselves, because we almost, none of us lives alone and, you know, without contact with other people.
And our brains evolved in the same way, right? We're a very social animal. That's maybe why our brains are what they are. When you put it that way, I hadn't thought of it this way. It almost seems weird to not think about the social side of our brains if we want to be smarter, whatever that means.
Right. That's kind of the conclusion I came to as well, because we have a lot in common with other social species, both in terms of, you know, how we interact and construct our social interactions. And then also just in the way our brains operate. There are a lot of, you know, mammalian social species anyway. And, you know, it's interesting because all these promises are about, you know, improving your smarts, as it were. But so few things focus on, well, how do you get along with each other better or interact with each other better or understand each other better?
Talking to Emily Willingham about her new book, The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about our brains and how to better them. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emily, our brains are pretty complicated. One tricky thing, it turns out, if we want to make our brains better or smarter or whatever, it's really hard to measure success, right?
Right. I mean, it depends on what you're trying to measure. But if you're talking about something like your intelligence, you know, the measures for those have a lot of things that complicate them or confound them. And they're not by any means pure measures of what our capacities are. And so that's hard to capture. It carries a lot of the biases of, you know, who's doing the testing and making the tests.
Now, let's look at different possible approaches to the bettering of the brain. As I mentioned, there are a lot of places we could spend our money for supplements or brain training apps. Should I be whipping out my credit card and going online right now to sign up for these things?
Well, so I have good news for you. No, you don't need to do that. What I found was, I was surprised by it because I came to a lot of this pretty agnostically. And what I found is that we really don't, most of the things that seem to have the biggest effects don't cost us money. You move around, you know, physical activity, you engage with other people. And yes, I was most surprised, I think, by the mindfulness effects and how that does seem to improve a lot of the things that we maybe should be focused on improving.
Let's talk about that doing things with other people. One of the things that does stand out as showing brain improvement, as you write about in the book, is doing some kind of learning or creative activity in a context with other people. Sounds kind of like school, say. What kind of things do we know work when we get together and boost our brains, plural?
It's interesting because it kind of helps us organize around who we are relative to other people. We can draw the boundary of ourselves versus someone else, and we can also put ourselves in their shoes and share experiences with them and come to understand those experiences as well, which expands our minds. And when we learn things about other people, we show curiosity about other people, we're constantly incorporating that information into our own worldview and weaving that in and even using that to sort of make predictions and solve problems. It's all just an ongoing learning process when we interact with other people that way.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ross is with us from Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hey, Rob. So I retired a year and a half ago or so and looked at a guitar a few times when I was younger and then finally thought, well, why don't I learn an instrument, which is something, no real musical background. So that's been a real challenge, learning to read music, learning to put my fingers wherever they're supposed to go. And kind of related to what you guys were saying was, it's, you know, whether or not my brain is getting bigger or smaller, I don't know. But I find that there's no way in heck that I would play in front of people that to play music in front of them. But what I do enjoy is practicing with other people that are also learning.
Yeah. What does that feel like, Ross? What, how does it feel playing alone at home, say, versus in a group, interacting with other people as you're learning?
Right. So when you're on your own, you can kind of go in whatever direction you want to go. I mean, I do need some structure because I don't have the skill set to just sort of teach myself. So there's some tools out there that can kind of help you to learn it. So I like the idea of sort of going with something, saying I'm not going to do this and I'm going to do that. And then when I'm with there's some Zoom classes because we're in this COVIDian age, and it's sort of nice just to be able to just sort of see different people at different stages, more or less beginning. And it just makes it easier to sort of play in front of other people.
Ross, thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Emily, Ross, kind of a poster child for a lot of what you're saying.
Yeah, I like to hear that story. That was a great story. There is something to be said to having other people at the table as you learn and you see where they need help and you can help them or they can help you. And this exchange of ideas is another reason, I think, to kind of have more people at your brain table with you and to have those exchanges, get that satisfaction.
Ross, thanks again for calling in at 800-642-1234. That reminds me about you've got a chapter on creativity and boosting our creativity, our creative minds in particular. What kind of things seem to work well for that?
You know, it's interesting, again, it's other people, it turns out. I mean, it's not just in the brainstorming sense, although that can help. But as I've gotten older, especially, this has become more obvious to me. But when you do include other people, when you're trying to think of things or solve a problem or come up with ways to do it, they can come up with things that you're never anywhere near. And I just think that that's so useful. And it does help with creativity to have other people contributing.
And one supplement that does seem to help is eating fruits and veggies.
I had to put that in there for the sake of, you know, parents everywhere, but it's just a very sort of, you know, low level of evidence that's suggested in a couple of studies that that yes, that consumption was associated with, it doesn't mean it's causal, but associated with sort of better creativity scores.
So maybe creative people like their fruits and veggies. It could go
either way. Yeah, exactly. There's some potential conflation there.
We're talking to science writer Emily Willingham about her new book, The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that you find makes you feel better and think more clearly, think smarter? Have you already been doing some of the things we've been talking about with our guest? Is there a social activity that you do, maybe while you're learning something along the way that you don't know if it makes you feel smarter? Maybe you do, but it makes you feel better as you're doing it. And what questions do you have for our guest about some of the brain science she's been researching? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with science writer Emily Willingham about her new book, The Tailored Brain. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on how to build a better brain. Are there little things you do to try to keep your brain working well, to feel smarter or think more clearly? Do you do creative things with other people? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Roger is with us in Grantsburg. Roger, hi.
How you doing? Love your show. Great topic today.
Thanks.
I was curious if she had any sections in her book about linking your subconscious with your conscious and your dreams and making, you know, heads or tails, I guess heads or tails out of your dreams. And if you can link that into your conscious and use it.
Roger, thanks for the call. I talked to a dream researcher not that long ago who said dreams are still pretty mysterious. Emily, any thoughts on doing the things Roger is hoping to do? He wants to link our subconscious with our conscious and learn from our dreams.
I didn't directly address that in the book, but I did look at some of what it might mean if you remember your dreams. And there's there may be some distinction in brain connectivity between people who wake up and remember enormous detail about their dreams and people who don't. So there's certainly something going on there, and it might be related to memory and what we can retain in memory.
Roger, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Terry on Facebook writes, I'm not familiar with mindfulness. Can you address what it is? Talk a little more about it. You'd mentioned a mindfulness, Emily, as one of these tools to help develop our brains.
Yeah, mindfulness is actually kind of a bucket term that people use. It can be defined in a lot of ways, but essentially it's where you draw yourself, I'm going to define it my way. Mm-hmm. You draw yourself into the moment. You observe what's going on around you right now without like the sort of ruminatory spiraling that you can get into. And you just observe without judgment and sort of focus on what's happening in the moment. I think one of a sort of easily accessible activity that's related to it is a breathing activity where you just do deep breathing and exhalations for, you know, a minute or two and just really focus on doing that to just kind of recenter yourself and get yourself out of your own brain.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Stephanie is with us in New Berlin. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. This was a cool topic. It kind of made me think of like when I've been traveling to different countries, I see a lot of people like going out and learning how to play chess together. So sometimes we're at parks, they're like, we'll go to like different locations, you know, so people just like hanging out, socializing, bringing a chessboard and just like hanging out and be able to do that. So I like to do that actually a lot, like with a friend or a partner or something, just go out to like a cool cafe or like a brewery outside. I don't see that as much around here, but it's really fun, and I encourage other people to try it too.
Stephanie, that's great. I have done that. It's something I hope to do in the future, hopefully at a more post-COVIDian age, as one of our callers said earlier. Do you get funny looks, or when people see you doing it, do they say, yeah, I want to do that too?
actually, yeah, people are like really curious and like, oh, that's really cool. I never thought of that before, you know? So it's just like, why not? Like, you can sit at home and do it, or you can go outside and like have fun, enjoy the fresh air, or like sit at a park and have a picnic and play some chess, you know? So there are a lot of portable chess boards that are like magnetic. So it makes it much easier to do something like that. But there's a lot of good ones where you can just take them with you and like fold them up when you're done. So I think it's a fun idea.
Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing that. And Emily, I think we might think, oh, if I play on a chess app against a robot, that's going to boost my brain. Stephanie's way is going to be way better from what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because they've looked at chess very closely, including somebody who's a chess master. He loves chess, but you know, if you play chess just on your own, you get better at playing chess, but it doesn't necessarily transfer and make you, you know, like Bradley Cooper in the movie Limitless. But what your caller just described, Stephanie, I believe, it's just, you know, a fabulous way to spend your time. You're outside, you're getting that kind of boost from being in nature, you're getting a boost from doing this with other people. Games are fun. If you love chess, that's fun. All of these things are very positive activities that can kind of clear your brain of some of its burden and let you just have a good time.
Stephanie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Emily Willingham, author of the new book, The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. A couple other things I wanted to get into, Emily. You talk about this idea of cognitive overload. And if we could figure out how to deal with that, it's, you know, it may not make us permanently smarter, but it's going to help us think more clearly in the moment. What is cognitive overload? How do we fight it?
It's when you've got too many things going on in your brain so that you lose the ability to make sort of cool-headed decisions, for example. I think of myself as like, you know, being in the kitchen, there's a toddler hanging onto your leg, the pot's boiling over, something just caught on fire, your phone rings, and someone rings the doorbell. That's kind of a lot. That's cognitive overload. And in that situation, if somebody came up to me and said, Emily, I'm going to give you $20 right now, but if you wait 15 minutes, I'll give you 40, I would say, give me the 20 and get out of here. I've got to deal with this fire. So, you know, that's what cognitive overload can feel like. And there are lots of accessible ways to offload some of that. We use, you know, Google, like electronic calendars and things like that is one way that we do it. So we don't have to keep remembering all of those things ourselves. We share with friends. We tell each other stories and, you know, help each other problem solve. All of these are tactics for releasing some of that burden.
I have a very personal example. When I first became a radio host, hosting an afternoon talk show, doing the interviews and doing all the prep. And if I went and met my wife and kids at a restaurant after, the menu was too much. Mm. I could not do that level of research at that point. Gradually got better. I got used to it. I think the stress came out of it. Can we just kind of, if things become routine, I guess, if we dial down the stress and anxiety, is that one way to help overcome that cognitive overload?
Yeah, absolutely. I think those two things interact. I think a cognitive, you know, overload creates stress and anxiety. And if you're extremely stressed or anxious, you have more trouble, you know, making decisions because it's taking up so much of your resource or what resources you have available just to deal with feeling all of that stress or anxiety. So absolutely.
Another thing you spend some time on that I love is the power of storytelling and involved with that empathy for other people. Can you tell us how we can use that and what it can do for us?
It was one of my favorite things to discover in the research for this book. And it's a way to connect with minds that are, you know, apart from us in miles or even by centuries and learn what was in those brains and to share that with them. And when you read a story, not only do you have to kind of understand and try to predict and problem solve what's going on with the characters in the story, but you're also in the mind of the person who's telling that story. And you're trying to do some mind reading with that as well. And all of this is just excellent practice for the key skills of being a human being.
So a nice thing about so many of the things you've talked about today is there are things we can kind of integrate into our daily lives. Having gone through all this research, are there some of these things you've taken up and you find yourselves doing them on a daily basis?
I do. And it's the mindfulness thing, especially. This is not something that I'm naturally attracted to doing. And I and I didn't come to this with like, woo, I'm just going to be mindful now. But I was writing this book largely during the entirety of this pandemic, and I found so much utility in just doing that thing where you pause, you stop the anxiety spiral, you stop the rumination spiral, you look around you, you just take note of what's there right now in this moment. You're doing all right. and just, you know, just go from, take it from that baseline.
I feel like so many of the things you're talking about, if I were a Silicon Valley company, I'd have a hard time bundling up. Yeah, just think more about what you're doing and talk to other people more. Maybe eat some fruits and veggies. I don't know. It seems like, I guess I understand why there's a bias toward we've got a pill.
I guess so, but I think they're kind of, you can tell they're sort of onto something because of this whole trend toward the health apps. You know, the three things I found were like being with other people, some kind of mindfulness practice and physical activity. And I, you know, if you're paying attention to what they're doing with apps, they're like, here's your physical activity app. Hmm. If you have an Apple Watch, it's like telling you to breathe all the time. It's time to do your breathing practice. And so, you know, they see this at least that it's, there's some openings here.
As you, as we wrap up, you write your, one of your goals here is to help people in some ways find a peace as they deal with their brains and try to make them better. What would that look like?
Well, I think that the first step is to interrogate why you think you have something that you need to change or improve, and whether that's something that's coming from inside of you or is being imposed on you. So I think that's one question to ask. And then the other question is to think, well, what would be the best thing to improve? Do I need to be, you know, 3 quote unquote IQ points smarter? Or would it be better if I'm on Twitter and somebody says something kind of that makes me mad? Do I come out with a gut punch at them right out of the gate? Or do I just let it go by and practice a little kind of non-judgmentalism and, you know, save myself that effort and then maybe some pain.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Emily Willingham is a science writer, and we talked to her today about her new book. It's called The Tailored Brain, From Ketamine to Keto to Companionship, A User's Guide to Feeling Better and Thinking Smarter. We often hear elected officials and political analysts blame tribalism for stark division in the United States. The idea is we pick a side, a team, we dig in too far, and it becomes a case of us versus them. But our next guest says it doesn't have to be that way, and that our group identities can actually help us get along with others, even outside our own groups, if we do it right. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the country's more divided than you've ever seen in your life? Why or why not? Do you think it comes from particular groups or the way we buy in, the way we pick sides, pick teams? What do you think can work to bridge those divisions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dominic Packer is a psychology professor at Lehigh University and co-author of the book, The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic with his co-author called The Myth of Tribalism. Dominic, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me today.
Well, we sometimes hear this term tribalism thrown around a lot these days, I think, in American politics in particular. Can you offer us more of a definition of what people, of how people are using it?
Yeah, I think when people use the word tribalism, they're trying to reach for a sense of the toxicity of that group relations can turn into. And I think as we look out at our political landscape, there clearly are toxic relations both between groups, right? A lot of vitriolic language and dislike and unwillingness to compromise, and also some problematic dynamics even within groups, sort of intolerance of dissent and internal critique and people who might raise alternative ideas, especially if they're too much like the other side. And so when people use the word polarization, they're trying to capture that general sense that things have somehow gone off the rails. And although it's a good word to describe that, we don't think it's inevitable.
We'll get into that. I want to get to some of the basics of human group identity, though. It's a super natural thing for us to identify with a particular group of people or many different groups of people. Can you talk about that as a sort of fundamental bit of our humanity?
That's right. So we argue that human beings are fundamentally groupish, that if there's something built in and innate, it's not necessarily a tribal kind of instinct, and especially that sort of toxic group dynamic that I was talking about before. But certainly we have a strong propensity to identify with groups, so much so that you can put people in completely novel groups and they'll immediately feel some sort of allegiance to them. So there's these famous experiments from the 1970s that have informed a lot of the work that we do called the minimal group experiments, which essentially put people randomly into a group they've never heard of before, a team A or a team B, or we've often used the lions and the tigers. And as soon as you're part of that category, although you know nobody in that group, you're never going to interact with people in the group, it nevertheless starts to feel important to you. And when given the chance to, say, divide resources between your group and another group, people will tend to give more to their own team that, again, they'd never heard of even 5 minutes before. So there's certainly this readiness to identify with groups, and it comes on very quickly and strongly.
Well, I want to talk about a group you identify with, one you have with your co-author. You share a story in your book, one of you, a small town hockey playing kid, the other kind of a big city type, but skeptical of each other at first, brought together by a piece of cheese. Could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Right. So we met at graduate school at the University of Toronto and initially didn't get along that well, in part because my collaborator, Jay, moved from a small town in Alberta where he had lots of room into a tiny apartment in the middle of Toronto with no place to store his goalie equipment. So he decided to bring it into our shared office. And anyone who's played hockey or been around hockey players knows that that's smelly stuff. And it's a sub-basement office with no ventilation. So we weren't necessarily get us off on the right foot. But shortly thereafter, the department had an event, and afterwards there was a wine and cheese. And as we were in conversation with a group of people, Jay choked. This piece of cheese lodged in his throat and he couldn't breathe. And it took me a while to figure out what was going on. Initially, the bartender tried to give him the Heimlich and it actually dislodged. And then Jay grabbed me and dragged me to the bathroom opposite the reception room. And I figured out what was happening and I gave him the Heimlich and eventually the cheese popped out and rolled across the floor. And I was horrified. I wanted to go home and collapse. And Jay thought it was hilarious and wanted to go and eat more cheese. But the stress of that moment sort of brought us together in a funny kind of way. And after that, we started talking to each other more and getting more interested in each other's ideas. And ultimately, we've now worked together for more than 15 years.
And I wanted to ask about that story, A, because there's cheese in it and we're in Wisconsin, but B, it's a very small scale example of a way that you were divided initially by a couple of your group identities. A unique shared experience brought you together. There could be lessons here, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things that can bring people together, in this case as a dyad, but in groups more generally, are adverse circumstances. We argue in our book that circumstances can often conspire to create a sense of solidarity. And sometimes these are good things that are happening, but sometimes they're bad things. In this particular example, right, choking on cheese is a pretty traumatic kind of event. But we see again and again, for example, during times of crisis, whether it's a natural disaster, some sort of terrorist attack, or even potentially a global pandemic, that in response to this common challenge, people can respond by recognizing they have common goals and that by working together, they can achieve those goals more effectively than they could on their own. And so it becomes a source of solidarity in moments of crisis.
Talking to psychology professor Dominic Packer, co-author of the book, The Power of Us. He co-wrote a piece for The Atlantic called The Myth of Tribalism, looking at our group identity, how it can divide us, but how it can bring us together, too. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Dominic, let's get into this tribalism idea now. What is it that determines if I'm in a group and I identify with it so strongly that it turns into a negative thing toward other people versus, I don't know, our shared values within that group that help us get along with people even outside that group?
That's right. So what we argue, and this is based on extensive research, both ours and other people's, is that when you identify with a group, that's almost like the fuel that drives your activity. It's propelling you to want to do things that you see as good for the group and pursue the group's goals. But what those activities are, what that behavior is very much determined by the norms of the group. And the norms set the direction. So it's like the identity is the fuel and the norms are the direction. And group norms can take all kinds of forms. They can certainly be toxic and insular and parochial and discriminatory. They can be anti-dissent. On the other hand, they can be open and warm and inclusive, both internally, seeking out criticism and enjoying and celebrating people who raise alternate ideas, but also even, you know, being helpful outside your group, and in some cases, in extreme cases, perhaps of charitable organizations, in some cases, doing more good outside the group than they would do internally. And so it's what the norms are that really shape people's behaviors. And for that reason, I think it's really important to get people thinking about group norms and not just the degree to which they identify.
Okay, so if I'm in a group, call it Team Republican or Team Democrat, say, and I feel like, yes, I believe in the principles that I share with this group, and I'm going to vote and I'm going to work for my team, but I'm worried that my team, my party, is getting too confrontational. It's not willing to follow the rules anymore. That worries me. That's betraying why I got into this. How can I start to try to change that or to bring back even that shared value?
I mean, that's the central question, or one of the central questions of the time we live in, I think. I mean, first of all, I think it's important to recognize what these dynamics are, which is one of the reasons we wrote this book, is helping people to see how powerful these group norms can be in shaping how we see the world and what we think is appropriate. And then to recognize that, well, maybe they're not necessarily always the best thing, and not necessarily in just an objective sense, but maybe they're not the best thing for us, right? That for our group, this is having some negative consequences. And if you can get people to think about that, how is the way we're behaving counterproductive to our own long-term interests or to our sense of our own ethics or values, they can start to question those kinds of behaviors. So that's, I think, an important step, is to reflect on your own responses and behaviors and think how you might like to do things differently. And the other, I think, is to at least partially recognize the incentive structures, especially in online kind of social media environments, where people are being rewarded for incredibly divisive and incendiary kinds of rhetoric. And often it feels good when you see someone sort of hammering the other side and you see them insulting. And so you give it a like or you give it a retweet. It's sort of like, yeah, let's go. What we would encourage people to do is take a step back from that. Again, if you don't like those norms, and a lot of people say they don't like how toxic it's become, then we need to stop rewarding it. Because the people who do this, the pundits and the politicians who engage in this sort of overinflated inflammatory rhetoric, are responsive to incentives. They're doing it because it gets attention and because it gets rewarded by being spread widely.
We're talking with Lehigh University psychology professor Dominic Packer about social and political divisions, how to bridge them, and what he calls the myth of tribalism. He's co-author of the book, The Power of Us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a social group, a political group you feel like you identify with? Are there lots of them? And sometimes they might lead you in different directions. Do you think we have gotten too divided, especially politically, maybe socially in this country? What kind of things do you think would work to bridge those divides? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about tribalism with Dominic Packer. He co-wrote a new book called The Power of Us and a piece in The Atlantic on the myth of tribalism, looking at the ways that our group identities can bring us together instead of pulling us apart. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we can or should become less divided as a society? Are you hopeful we could start to become a little more reunited? How would you like to see social groups held accountable when they engage in divisive behavior? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I don't really like the two-side narrative because, you know, there's 300 million people in the United States. People are different. We have, and then the other thing about that is that it's the divisive because it puts you into two sides, which I don't think it really should be. And then the internet allows people to say things that they would never say in person. So I think it's almost like anti-social media because people don't usually behave in the manner that they behave on the internet. And also, I remember the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, indivisible. And on our money, it says our motto, E Pluribus Unum. Out of many, one. And this is the idea that needs to be, you know, we're communities. We're not like sides. You know, we're not, I think that's just being used by politicians for power and influence.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Willem, Dominic gave us a lot to work with there. Where do you want to start?
I think Willem makes really great points. Sometimes the way political scientists talk about polarization is actually a useful way to think about it, I think. They describe polarized societies as societies where there's been a flattening of identity. You take a society where people have all sorts of different parts of themselves, and they crisscross in ways that are not perfectly overlapping. So you have religious affiliations, and there's where you live, and there's your occupational identity, and then there's your political beliefs. And they're all partially overlapping, but you're also part of different groups with different people who think differently from you, and that's a healthy way for society to be. It's also an exciting way to live. What happens with extreme polarization is all of that diversity of identity gets flattened into a single dimension, so that everybody is essentially now being defined by where they fall on one spectrum from left to right. And it doesn't feel good, and it's quite boring, and it's certainly not healthy for societies. And so I think the point Lone's making is that a lot of people don't want that. They don't want to be flattened into that single sort of dimension. And we should be helping people recover aspects of themselves and bring other aspects of themselves to interactions with each other.
And it seems like you could do that, Dominic, on social media, but the opposite happens, as Willem points out. If you are in a political debate with someone online, it's really easy to collapse their identity and your own identity into that one dimension, that one side.
Absolutely. So we argue in our book that social media certainly didn't create polarization, but that it's acted as an accelerant. That if you introduce social media platforms into a society that's already struggling with this sort of issue, it tends to make things worse. And my collaborator, Jay at NYU, has done amazing work looking at the dynamics of interactions on social media platforms, and especially what sort of content in a tweet or a Facebook post tends to go viral. And what they find is that the content that's much more likely to be shared contains words that they describe as moral emotional. So they're not just moral words like good or bad. They're words like disgust or hate, which these strong moralistic connotations and a ton of emotional content. And then if you pair that with a mention of the political outgroup, it's even more likely to go viral. And so this is the stuff that spreads online. And again, that incentivizes people who want to get attention, politicians and pundits in particular, to use that sort of language, because it gets picked up and it gets shared in ways that have these pretty negative consequences overall.
Thanks for that call, Willem, at 800-642-1234. Mitch joins us next in Milwaukee. Mitch, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mitch?
I just wanted to bring up, I think that if we focused our education on teaching morals, ethics, and logic, we'd be much better off as a society than we are today.
And are you thinking, like, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, Kantism specifically, like moral philosophy.
Mitch, thanks for the call. Mitch thinks some early education in ethics and philosophy could help us out. What do you think, Dominic?
I think it couldn't hurt. One of the things we would argue in the book is that behavior is, because it's shaped by our identities, and we all have multiple identities, and they can come in and out of focus at different times, it's important to take that into account when we're thinking about ethics, because somebody who might live ethically and by a certain set of standards in much of their lives could still find themselves in a situation where they're part of a group with a very strong pattern of norms that would actually lead them away from that. And it's important to recognize that that can happen, and to put it on pause and say, okay, I don't want to go down that road. I don't like these norms. I either need to leave this group, or I need to try and change how this group is behaving.
Thanks for that call, Mitch, at 800-642-1234. Dominic, something that struck me in your book and that I've heard elsewhere sometimes is our perception of how divided we are. We hear from the most polarized people on social media and in the news sometimes, and looking at it through that lens, it might seem like everybody is at each other's throats. Everybody is leaping to one side or the other of the divide. But there's a lot of people out there who aren't so front and center. Do we need to focus more on them to get a better picture?
I think so. I think that a distorted picture, an over-exaggerated picture of polarization in some ways makes it worse. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's an important distinction between different kinds of polarization. One is called affective or emotional polarization. And I think there's little doubt that we are living through a peak of that kind of dynamic right now, that people feel a lot of negativity toward the other side. And in that sense, we are very polarized. But there's another kind of polarization, which is called issue or ideological polarization, which is much more about what do we actually think about real issues? Where do we stand on tax policy and how healthcare should work? Even something like gun control, which is very contested. And what you find in the American population is that when you actually drill down into real policy issues, there's way more agreement than people think there is. The left and the right actually tend to be pretty much aligned on a whole bunch of things where if only we could get past this emotional reaction, we could actually find some compromise. There's definitely room there to compromise, but if you don't see it, then you don't have those interactions, you don't have those conversations, and we don't actually move anything forward.
Talking to Dominic Packer, psychology professor, co-author of the book, The Power of Us, looking at a divided America, polarization, and how to overcome it. Let's go now to Jack in Viola. Jack, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. The issue I see, it's really nice to say, okay, let's all do us together. I mean, I really support that psychology. But when I've listened and seen a lot of things, it comes down to two principles. One is a zero-sum approach or strategy, and the other one is a win-win. And it seems this culture is really struck on that because, the win-win type of thing is the optimal strategy. The win-lose is a zero-sum strategy. And there are people who believe that, you know, their right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, you know, well, if it comes at your cost, it comes at your cost.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Dominic, I know this is something that psychologists and political researchers think about a lot. What do you have to say to Jack?
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I think if you see problems as inherently zero sum, we're competing over a resource, and if we win, you lose, and if you win, we lose, then it's very hard to reach compromise. And that if we can reframe problems to be one so that we have to find a solution where we all gain somehow, there's some greater collective benefit, then that is a path forward. And I'll give a plug just very quickly for somebody else's book called How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart by Jamal Green, who has a really interesting case to make about how the conception of rights as being zero sum, if I have a right, then you don't have a right, is part of the toxic dynamic in American politics, and that rethinking how we think about even something as fundamental as rights can help us reach that more win-win kind of approach.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Dominic, are you hopeful that we can get away from the us versus them, worst case, tribalized identities, and, I don't know, see each other as full people again?
Depends which day you ask me on. I think I'm hopeful that we can certainly do it, but I'm not always optimistic that we will do it quickly or that it'll be easy to do.
What's a step that you would recommend to somebody listening right now to, in their small way, help bridge that gap?
I would say when you're interacting with people online, offer some grace. You know, remember that people are multifaceted and that they probably have aspects of their identities that actually they share with you, even if it's not so visible. That's one thing. And the other is hold politicians and pundits to account. If they're using language you don't like, and many of us say we don't like this toxicity, then don't reward it. Whether it's the other side or your own side, just because it feels good to retweet something that's, you know, slamming the other side, don't retweet it if you don't like these dynamics.
Dominic, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Rob.
Dominic Packer is a psychology professor at Lehigh University, co-author of the book, The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. He was with us today talking about social and political divisions and some of the ways we can help bridge them.